Ladies and gentlemen, our next speaker, Dr. Robert Forrestone, is rightly acknowledged to be the foremost Holocaust revisionist scholar in the world today. In his native France, his name has appeared in countless newspaper headlines and is recognized throughout the country. It is a name admired by friends and detested by enemies. Dr. Forrestone addressed the first IHR conference in 1979, and he has spoken at, I think, six conferences since then, including the last one in 1990. As a boy and a young man, he attended schools in Singapore, Japan, and in France. He was educated at a lycée in Paris and at the renowned Sorbonne. He received his state doctorate in letters and the humanities from the Sorbonne in 1972, where he also taught from 1969 to 1964. He is the author of four books on French literature. From 1974 until earlier, from 1974, Forrestone has been associate professor of French literature and a specialist in text and document analysis at the University of Lyon II in France. He taught there from 1974 until 1979. Since 1978, Dr. Forrestone has presented his critical view of the Holocaust extermination story in numerous articles, in interviews over French national radio, in two books, in a videotape, and in a stunning April 1979 debate on a Swiss television network with prominent defenders of the exterminationist view. His writings have also appeared in America in translation, most notably, of course, in the Journal of Historical Review. A collection of his writings is currently being prepared for publication as a book by the IHR. Dr. Forrestone was an advisor to Henri Roque, who spoke at the 1987 IHR conference on his doctoral dissertation about the confessions of Kurt Gerstein. Forrestone worked closely on the French revisionist quarterly Annales d'Histoire Révisionniste during the 3 years of its existence, and he also worked on its successor quarterly, the Revue d'Histoire Révisionniste. Our next speaker played a very important role in both the 1985 and 1988 Holocaust trials in Toronto of Ernst Zundel. His role in these legal battles went far beyond his testimony on the stand as an expert witness. Especially during the 1985 trial, he spent hundreds of hours, usually working all day and very late into the night, preparing questions used by defense attorney Doug Christie in his devastating interrogations of Raoul Hilberg, Rudolf Verba, and other prosecution witnesses. Forrestone's most important role in the 1988 trial may very well have been his key part in arranging for Mr. Fred Lucher's investigation in Poland of supposed extermination gas chambers and in bringing the American engineer's testimony to world attention. It is fitting that Forrestone contributed the introduction to the published edition of the Lucher Report. For years, Forrestone persisted, virtually alone, in insisting on the importance of the American execution gas chamber as a key to exposing the fraud of the supposed German wartime extermination gas chambers, and on the importance of finding an American gas chamber specialist to confirm the revisionist view of the Holocaust story. Holocaust revisionism has had a tremendous impact in France, perhaps greater than in any other country, and much of the credit or blame for this belongs to our next speaker, who has defended the revisionist case with great skill, scholarship, and tenacity, and at great personal sacrifice. At the IHR conference in October 1987, Dr. Forrestone said that he is optimistic about revisionism, but pessimistic about revisionists. Events in France since then have vindicated his words. The situation in France is particularly tense and dangerous because of the so-called Fabius-Gassot Law of July 1990, which he referred to a little earlier, which makes it a crime to deny crimes against humanity as condemned at the Nuremberg trial of 1945 and 46. This law provides for a fine of up to 300,000 francs and a year in prison for violations. Robert Forrestone is not only the foremost revisionist scholar, that he has paid a heavier price for his views than any other revisionist historian. For more than a decade now, a coalition of powerful organizations has waged a concerted but unsuccessful legal battle to silence him. Because of this campaign, his family life has been repeatedly disrupted and thrown into turmoil. His health has suffered terribly. Not long ago, while I was looking through a book of quotations, I came across a Hebrew proverb that instantly brought Forason to mind. Quote, opinions founded on prejudice are always sustained with the greatest violence, unquote. Over the past years, our next speaker has been the victim of 6 beatings by criminal thugs. The most severe attack came on the September 16th, 1989, when he was almost killed. None of the criminal assailants in any of these attacks has ever been brought to justice. An indication of the impact that Forason has had in France is this recently published booklet written by French intellectual François Brignot. Its title might be rendered in English as something like, just who is this Professor Forason? He's shown here in a kind of cartoon wearing a deerstalker hat like Sherlock Holmes and smoking a Sherlock Holmes style pipe. And he has this little magnifying glass with books, one of them by himself entitled, Has Anyone Read Rimbaud? Which is a book he wrote about the French writer. And another one with this magnifying glass looking at a copy of The Diary of Anne Frank, our own Sherlock Holmes. In this book, the author notes the dramatic difference in how Dr. Forason has been viewed in respectable French academic circles over the years. The author compares the pre-Holocaust and post-Holocaust Forason. In a post-Holocaust Forason article that appeared in July in 1987 in the French Jewish periodical Le Monde Juif, the periodical's director, Georges Velers, called Forason, and I quote, the French star of negativism, a bizarre man, extravagant, a man who is against truth at any price, a demagogue, grotesque, stupid, and illiterate. Sadly, such comments about the post-Holocaust Forason are not at all rare in the French press. But the pre-Holocaust Forason was regarded rather differently. In 1972, the French Jewish scholar Pierre Citron, director of the UER at the New Sorbonne in Paris, called Forason, and I quote, a very brilliant professor, a very original researcher, and an exceptional personality. Well, Dr. Forason is still the same man, of course. He has not turned into a Mr. Hyde. Only his views about the most sacred of taboos has changed, and the guardians of the powerful Holocaust religion punish heretics. Our next speaker is regarded as perhaps the greatest of the Holocaust blasphemers. Ladies and gentlemen, I am once again pleased to introduce our next speaker, who has been a trusted colleague and a good friend since our first meeting in 1979. Please welcome Dr. Robert Forason.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would need very much time to thank Mark Weber, my friend, and also all the people of the staff of the IHR, our best bastion of revisionism, and I am afraid, because I'm going to be a little bit pessimistic, perhaps, at least for some time, the last, because our situation in Europe is more and more difficult. So I know that American people do not like pessimistic speakers. They like you to be positive. So I'm going to try to be positive anyway, okay? I will say something about Prayssac, my dear friend Prayssac, about his big fat book, about Fergasung, if I have enough time, and so on. But the title of my conference is, a little bit long, this title, The New Masada, Religious Myth as the Final Refuge of Holocaust Defenders. Now, what is Masada? I took a dictionary, and this is what we can read. Masada, the ancient site of Herod's palace and the mountain top where Jewish rebels carried out at a last stand against their Roman conquerors in the years 66-73. So excavations were made. Thousands of American and Israeli volunteers helped dig up scroll fragments, coins, shards inscribed with Hebrew letters, a building believed to have been a study house, and a pool used for ritual cleansing. And that's it. But perhaps you know the legend of Masada. It's absolutely fantastic. And when those people made those excavations, they thought, we are going to find something to substantiate what we have said about Masada, the heroism of those Jews and so on. Of course, they found nothing, but the fact that they found nothing, how must we ourselves react? We could say, good news, they found nothing for this stupid story. But believe me, sometimes it's better not to find anything, because the people can come and they can imagine what they want, what they wish. And this is what I call the religious mentality. Now, be careful, I'm not saying anything against people believing in God. I'm talking about people believing in what I call supernatural things. Do you remember that David Irving said, the Auschwitz battleship is sinking? This was in 1990. In my opinion, it's already sank. Do you say has sank or is sank? Has sunk. Has sunk. Okay. Has sunk. So this is a good news. I mean that the historians cannot anymore seriously maintain what they have said about Auschwitz. That the place where this battleship has disappeared becomes something sacred. And I'm sure that the rabbis and people like that are very pleased not to have any more historians on their side. Those people always, as you say in English, spilling the beans. The rabbis, they do never spill beans. They say it's like that, and you imagine exactly what you want. So I think that at one time, and I'm going to try to say when, the historians stopped trying to demonstrate that the Holocaust happened. Maybe you are surprised to hear this, but I maintain that. And the time when the religious myth, who already had begun years and years ago, expanded more and more. And today, I think that the future is nothing more for the historians, I mean our opponents, historians who are our opponents, and we have to fight against a kind of religious myth. And I must say that I, for one, I don't know how to fight this kind of myth. Sometimes people come and they say, Mr. Faurisson, how can I help you? And I say, you could help me by founding a religion against this one, because there is no example that reason could do something against a religious theft. It never happened. Only a religion is replaced by another one, okay? So, I am really surprised first that I have the possibility of talking like that in a free country. It's extraordinary. In 14 years, I have never been able to talk in France. I was once on the TV for 30 to 40 seconds, and the lady who presented me said to the people, to the listeners, now be careful, you are going to listen to a quasi-monster. And when it was finished, she said, you have listened to a quasi-monster. But I noticed that now we are total monsters. So you see, I think that I am a kind of total monster addressing, I suppose, total monsters. Of course, my exposé will be in three parts, as you know. So it will be my own retrospect and my own outlook on historical revisionism. I'll take what I call the historical myth, I would say 1945-46, until the beginning, perhaps, of 1988. Of course, this is a little bit artificial. Then the turning years, 1988, 1989, 1990. Then the pure religious myth, 1992, we don't know when. First part, the historical myth. If I had to draw the grave of this myth, I mean by historical, a myth defended by so-called historians, I think that I would put two dates. I think that it was born officially on the 15th of April 1946 in Germany at Nuremberg with the testimony of Hus. Born 15 April 1946. And I think that it died in Canada, in Toronto, at the second Zundel trial, the 20th of April, I'm sorry for 20th of April, 1988. Yes, at a time we had people to try to make us believe that all this was true and could be proved. And I am not going to give all their names. Remember Polyakov, Reitlinger, Hilberg, Gidelnake, Vélez, Davidovics, Ruckel, and the poor Christopher Browning. I think I could say why we won this battle, and how and when. I don't think that it was thanks to our books, our articles, because remember the silent treatment of our books, of our articles. I think that it was thanks to the two Zundel trials, 1985-1988. How did we proceed? We took the central pillar of all this construction, the gas chamber, and we decided for the first time to be materialistic. This is to say that we asked, now, what is a gas chamber? And as I told you this morning, please describe totally a Nazi gas chamber. Do you know that for 40 years, nobody thought of asking the question? You remember the Frankfurt trial, 1963, 1965. I don't know if you have seen a photo of the courtroom. Do you know in this Auschwitz trial with 22 defendants, do you know what was a gas chamber? It was a little rectangle, a plan of Auschwitz, and a little rectangle, and they would say, this is the gas chamber. Not one defense lawyer, not one defendant, nobody said, but your crime is supposed to be to have been in this place. What is this place? How is it physically? The question should have been, how could people enter in this ocean of hydrocyanic acid, a gas sticking everywhere, to handle 2,000 or 3,000 bodies, plenty of this poison? You cannot touch the body of somebody who has been overkilled, if I may say so, with hydrocyanic acid. This would be a magical gas chamber. We need an explanation. And I remember that at the first conference in 1979 in Los Angeles, I brought those stupid physical and chemical arguments. And I added something. I said, when you know what is an American gas chamber to execute people with hydrocyanic acid, you don't need even 1 minute to understand that what you are visiting in Auschwitz cannot be an homicidal gas chamber. And I was very surprised to think that this kind of argument, materialistic, physical, chemical, nobody had expressed it. How is it? You have so many, in Germany, you have so many brilliant chemists. They never thought of it, or perhaps they thought that they didn't say anything. In the United States, where you have those gas chambers to execute people, how is it that nobody reacted? Nobody said, but I know what is an American gas chamber. What is the story of those German gas chambers? And let me tell you something. The physical and chemical argument was rather well understood by the revisionist people. But when I said we need to compare this with an American gas chamber, and we need an expert, not a medical doctor, not a chemist, not a toxicologist, but a specialist of American gas chamber, I don't know why, and even though today I don't understand, how is it that I was not understood? I remember having struggles with some battles with some revisionists. Impossible to make the people understand that this was the solution. But one day, I received a phone call in January, I think, 1988, and Ernst Zundel told me, do you have your correspondence with the wardens of those American penitentiaries? I said, yes. I sent this correspondence to Zundel, and thanks to that correspondence, we got in touch with a man called Bill Armantrout, and then with Fred Leuchter. You say Leuchter, okay? So I had to wait something like 9 years to be understood on this very, very simple thing. Today, everyone says, among the revisionists, I've heard Mark Weber and David Cole in this TV show, everyone says, very easily, there was no order coming from Hitler to execute the Jews. It's very easy to say today, but remember 10 years ago. It's very easy to say there is no plan. It's very easy to say there was no budget. It's very easy to say now, to say we have no expertise of the weapon of the crime. It's really easy to say we have no, how do you say that in German, Obduktionsprotokoll for a body, no expertise. Autopsy, no autopsy report. You, today, thanks to our progress, you can say this, and the people in front of you, they are not going to say, oh, this is wrong. So this is what we said in 1985. We dared to say that. You need sometimes to be, you see, very specific and a little bit brutal. And I remember that in 1988, in Toronto, I added one sentence. I said, and there is no witness. Now, how could you say that there is no witness? I said, no witness has been cross-examined on the very facts of the alleged gassings. And I remember the judge jumping on his pen and saying, and he said, I should make a note of this. And at the beginning of the trial, which was supposed to last 4 months, at the beginning of the trial, the judge was sure that he would catch me about that. But at the end of the trial, they perfectly well realized that, in fact, no witness has ever been cross-examined on the very facts of the gassing. Now, in my numerous trials, when I see some survivors, they come and they say, how dare you? And they show me their tattoo. I am a living proof that this existed, and so on. So I'm very polite and I say, if you are a living proof of something, it's that there was not an extermination program. It seems that you are alive and very well alive. Or sometimes they say, yes, I was in Auschwitz, there were gas chambers. And I'm trying to find the difference between this kind of witness and the man, you know, who goes fishing. You call that an angler, I think. An angler comes back home and says, I have caught a fish, a 100-pound fish. Now, if you don't believe me, I'll show you the place. But of course, I am not asking for the place. I'm asking for the fish. But I can't never have this fish. So, in front of us, we had people like, let's take the best, Hilberg. Do you know that Hilberg in 1961 said there was a plan, there were, and so on. And in 85, he changed totally. And in between, you know that he said, I suppose you know that, that when he was asked now, how can you explain that without a plan, without an order, without a budget, without any organization, and so on, how is it that this was organized, this big massacre? And his answer is, there was an incredible mind reading by a far-flung German bureaucracy. Yes, do you imagine mind reading between bureaucrats? No phone, no letters, no fax, those Germans. I told you that for me, this myth, this historical myth, died on the 20th of April 1988. If I had to give a date when it entered what you call death throes, I think. You say that, death throes. So I like to give precise date. I would say the 2nd of July 1982 in Paris at a big convention. There was a big convention. They have decided to answer Faurisson and the Faurissonists. And they were going to have a press conference at the end of this big convention. And we were going to see what we are going to see. On the 2nd of July 1982, there was a poor press conference with only two of those people. And the journalist said, so, there was an order from Hitler to kill people. No, that's not exactly what we said. Yeah, you mean there was an order? No. And what about the gas chambers? Nothing, not one word. They were entering their agony at that time. Second part, the turning years, 1988-89-90. Something extraordinary happened in 1988. One Jewish professor who had attended this Sorbonne convention in 1982, published a book. You know this book, The Final Solution in History. Be very careful. In history means in history, not in the legend. And this man is a Princeton professor. His name is Arno Meyer. And I remember reading this book, and I think it was on page 363, because I was waiting for my gas chambers. I love my gas chambers. So I was turning nothing. Page 363, I think, or two or four. I found a left page. I found this sentence. I thought that I would fall from my chair. Sources for the study of the gas chambers are at once rare and unreliable. My dear, he said that, rare and unreliable. We had been fighting for years and years. People were saying sources for the study of the gas chambers are inimitable. Okay, you understood. And as solid as the rock, like the pyramids of Egypt, and so on. And now, those two little adjectives, rare and unreliable. And we could understand that something was turning very bad for those people. I mean our opponents. Remember that at that time, They decided that it was no more 4 million dead in Auschwitz, but 1 million, 1 million and a half. Then remember the counter-expertise in Auschwitz. They tried to say Luchter is wrong, but the result was that Luchter was right. And they put a comment to say, yes, but. Now, what is interesting is the silence about this counter-expertise made by the Poles. We should ask the journalists, why don't you say anything? You can say it's a good counter-expertise, it shows this or that, or it's bad, but say something about this counter-expertise. This silence is very important. I think that one of the most important thing as for history is the book of Prayssac. I didn't want to say anything, to ask any question about Prayssac. This book is really hilarious. It's a big fat book, and everywhere when I go out of France, because in France I cannot say anything, except in tribunals, to the tribunals. Also, I bring this big fact book, always bring it, and I say to the people, you see the title? The Auschwitz Gas Chamber, Technique and Operation. Now, I'm not very rich, but you will have 1,000 francs or dollars or whatsoever if you can find in this big fat book anything about the technique and the operation. The title is totally false. He says himself, most of the time he talks about disinfection, cremation, the life in Auschwitz, his love affair, and so on. Yeah, his love affair, yeah. And things like that. But what about the gas chamber? I'm looking once more, this is my idée fixe, excuse me, for a plan. Show me this magical gas chamber. And when Prayssac, now I've changed something. I wrote an article of 90 pages about this stupid book. In fact, I wrote an article of one paragraph and 90 pages. One paragraph to say, if he had found something in the American medias and everywhere, you would have big titles. You had nothing. The silent treatment, we are so used to it, but he got it, the silent treatment. And then in 90 pages, I tried to show the disaster for those people, okay? Today, I wouldn't do that, because things are changing extremely quickly. And this is what I would do today. I would say, oh, Prayssac, lucky man, you have found what you call a criminal trace, not a proof, the beginning of a proof. Okay, you have found a strange door, a document about a door. You have found a document about a tap. You have found a document about a fan, a suspicious document about a tap, suspicious about a fan, suspicious about a door. You have found a suspicious word, Vergasung. Prayssac, good for you. Good for you. I'm pleased for you. Now you are going to give me the total picture of a gas chamber. Do it. I'm waiting, still waiting. Nothing comes. Of course we can always take little details like that. Now, if you are interested by the word Vergasung, you could read also what I wrote about all this. I don't want to go into details. Now, about Prayssac all the same, we need, you see, Somebody said that revisionism could be great fan. I don't know if it's great fan, but I think that it's fan, this. For Kramer 4 and 5 in Birkenau, Prusak is there scratching his head and saying, now, how could they guess? There were gas chambers. Sure. Sure, because no proof, of course. Sure, but how could they manage, those Germans, to gas the people? Because if you see the place, there is only one explanation. The SS, the naughty SS, but the trained SS, would take a ladder and outside, from outside, would pour, you say pour, P-O-U-R, would pour Zyklon B through a kind of little window. But if you make calculations, and Prusak did calculations, the poor man has to do it at 6 different places and 3 times every time, which means 18 times. Do you imagine the SS in the wind, the snow, the rain, going, climbing this ladder and excuse me, doing tuk-tuk for the people to open, because you cannot open it from outside. So, tuk-tuk, please. Okay. And Prusak himself now, listen this, call this a circus act. And he said, this could have been easily changed, but the method of introducing the poison at Kramer 4 and 5, okay, remained the same. However, the camp authorities considering that a little physical exercise would do the medical orderlies responsible for guessing a world of good. You see, the failure of the historians, their last card, as we say, is Jean-Claude Prusak. On page 188, now if you can understand this about typhus and so on, see, he calculated that 2% of the Zyklon B was used to kill people and 98% to kill lice. Okay, I will say, good for you. And he says, the truth is that the SS used the extermination of the Jews, about which their superiors had a general knowledge without being informed of the practical details, to hide the terrible hygienic conditions in the camp, and to cover up their enormous consumption of the gas for disinfestation purposes. If knowledge of the disastrous state of affairs had reached Berlin, this would have had unfortunate consequences for Höss, who had recently been congratulated by Himmler and promoted in rank and his entourage, and for his entourage. Did you imagine this? And we have to answer this? Now, perhaps some people would say, all the same, there are some German historians trying all the same to defend the Holocaust, because of course the Germans would be the last historians to defend the Holocaust, of course. For instance, they have published a book called Die Schatten der Vergangenheit, The Shadows of the Past. So you take this book, 650 pages, and you look for, because it's supposed to be about genocide and so on, except an article totally ridiculous by a poor man called Wegener, you have nothing, but you have something, excuse me for the German people, excuse me, but you have something so typically German. Excuse me, I am a Frenchman. You see, you have the text. The text could be this. And you have the context. Okay? the Germans, they love context. So they go around the topic. Nothing about that. Nothing except the little thing of Wegener. And they go around talking about the ideology of National Socialism, of Adolf Hitler, of this and that. And it seems to me that I'm listening to enormous panzer. Boom, 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 boom. See, all around this. You have nothing today. I would like to have one historian to discuss with us. You must know that my own tragedy is that there is nobody. Now, it's finished. There is no debate because there is no people able to debate the historical subject. It's impossible. And you see, they are dematerializing the things. Even if you go to Auschwitz and so on, they begin to say, oh, the chimney is not exactly what it was. No, we changed something. It's a reconstruction. It's a reconstitution. You mustn't believe too much. We have to make the things easy for the people to understand. And so on. Exactly what Mr. Otto Frank told me about the diary of his daughter. Oh, Dr. Forisson, you must understand that we are trying to make the thing simple for the people and so on. And I'm sorry I have no time with all my lawsuits. I would like so much to write something about the Anne Frank diary because many new things arrived. They published an enormous new diary of Anne Frank. Yeah, I have it. Cost money in French, in Dutch, in German, in English. Yeah, but it's dematerialisé. For instance, I used to say, if you know how the premises are of this house, you see that the story is impossible. So what? No more plan in the book. They used to say, we have expertise, free expertise of handwritings and so on. And I said, according to those handwritings, expertise of handwritings and other things, we can deduce this, this and that. Now they dare to say, those expertise have no value. 1, 2 and 3. I came and I said, you see, you have a book of Schnabel on the traces of Anne Frank. If this is the book that I must believe, so those are my conclusions. And now they say this book has no value. And we are discovering things and things. For example, that Mr. Frank never left Netherlands Germany, because of the Nazi, he was living in Frankfurt. No, it was because he had a dirty, story of traffic of foreign currency. He was a banker. He had a trial, even in the Frankfurter Allgemeine. At that time, they talk about that. So he left the country, and he was not, of course he was afraid of the Nazi coming, of course, but he sent every summer his daughters to the grandmother in Germany until 1938. We are discovering really a swindler, but you see, that's it. In 1988, and this will be the end of the turning years, I attended the Oxford Convention organized and financed by Maxwell. You know Maxwell, okay. And I was rather surprised because people came from all over the world to show that the revisionists were wrong. Now, I didn't make any calculations, but I think that two-thirds of the people were theologians. The answer is now given by theologians. So, rabbis, Catholic priests, Protestant pastors, and so on. And I'm coming to the third part, the pure religious myth. You see, a man like Yehuda Boer, B-A-U-E-R, of Yad Vashem, I think I've been following the man for some years. I think that he had understood that it's finished now for the historians. And in an article that Mark Weber mentioned, you could see that he says that, in fact, the Holocaust is very well alive because we have so many now ceremonies, museum, novels, films, etc., etc., repeating the dogma. They say more and more now the Jewish people are too shy. They do not talk enough. They should repeat and repeat, no matter if they have any competence or not. And I noticed something, a change among those people like Klarsfeld. They used to attack the Christian people and to say, you Christian people, you have done nothing for us during the war. Now Klarsfeld and company, they are changing totally. They say, oh, you Christian people, you were so wonderful during the war. And we have to make now a kind of holy alliance. Pastors, rabbis, priests, and so on. And in France, if you take the example of France, it's very surprising to see how much now people of the church are the first to condemn revisionism, and especially Monsignor de Courtrai, not to speak about Monsignor Lustiger. Okay. But you could see something. They don't ask for the atheists, people who do not believe in God. They don't ask them to come on their side. Absolutely not. They need people like those de Courtrai and company. And as for ourselves, we are treated as heretics and as deniers. Now, let me tell you something about the words deniers and denial. I do not accept those words. I am not a denier, and there is no denial of the Holocaust. Would you say that Galileo was denying that the earth was flat or motionless? No. Galileo affirmed, after researches of other people and researches of his own. We are people who affirm that the final solution of the Jewish question was nothing more than emigration, if possible, and evacuation or deportation, if necessary. There is no denial. You could say that we are Holocaust skeptics, that there is an Holocaust skepticism. But please never use this word, and if people ask you, do you deny, please put it clearly, you are not a denier. We are treated now in France and elsewhere as real criminals. You know that. Since this famous law of 1990. And the news are really very bad, I must say. Pierre Guillaume, because of Jewish demonstrations day after day, had to close down his revisionist bookshop. Our review
Revue d'Histoire Révisionniste is finished.
There are convictions and convictions coming in France against young people and very, I must say, very brilliant people. For instance, in Fontainebleau near Paris, in Nice, or in Caen. And to give you an example of what it is, I wanted to testify in Fontainebleau for a young man who had only published a cassette of mine, radio cassette, okay? It was about the gas chambers. I came to the tribunal, and the lady, we don't have a judge and a jury, we had three judges. And the lady said, "What is your name?" Forisson. "Your first name?" "Robert." "When were you born? Where do you live?" etc. And she said, "I'm going to listen to you now. Be careful. You have no right to pronounce the word gas chambers." So I said, "Now, there is something wrong." And I tried to explain. She said, "Shut up. Get out." In Nice, a young man who wants to be a professor had only written, "Poisson is right, gas chamber equal rubbish." And he's very heavily condemned, and even they have suppressed his civic rights for 5 years, which means that he cannot be a professor and he cannot be a civil servant in France, etc., etc. You know what happened, I suppose, to the Münchner Anzeiger in Munich. You know what happened to David Irving in Italy and now in Canada. You know what happened to Hunzig in Austria. Now Hunzig and also Hohensberger are in exile in Spain. And so on, and so on. I remember having said in March 1991 to David Irving, if I may tell you something, because I am already a rather old man, revisionism is one bad news a day, one humiliation a week. Be careful. And to give you other examples, I have 3 trials today, and I go back to France quickly because of those, and I think that 3 others are coming. But the 3 that I have are for one interview in September 1990, and you know that you have in this country what you call double jeopardy, okay? You cannot be sued twice for one thing. I am sued 3 times for one thing. As I said, you see, if I had stolen, or if I had been accused of having stolen a bicycle, I would have a first trial for the handlebars, the second one for the front wheel, another one for the rear wheel. And the strength of this religion is that it is integrated into a very old one of 4,000 years, the Jewish religion. And you see, you cannot grasp it. You have nothing more. If even you go in Auschwitz, it's a little bit like in Treblinka. Treblinka is perfect. Have you been to Treblinka? In Treblinka, the gate is symbolic. Symbolic is the word. The rail track, symbolic. The place where the Jews disembarked, symbolic. The place where they would undo their cloth, symbolic. The gas chambers, symbolic. The place where they were burned, symbolic. So you have nothing. It's totally vague. And that's excellent for the people who come to dream. You see? And I had the curiosity of looking. I wanted to know what was the origin of the word gas. I don't know if you know the origin of the word gas. Very interesting. The origin is chaos. C-H-A-O-S. And it was invented in the 16th, 17th century by a Belgian doctor. And it was supposed to design something that you could not see, a kind of invisible humor in every body, you see? And I think that this represents very well how much this story of the gas is already magic. And for the people who like Wagner, people who don't like other theater coming with and trying to find something and so on, it's perfect. There is a kind of comfort in that. Conclusion. You know the UNESCO. UNESCO. You know that they have a list of places to be preserved as a treasure of our common heritage. If you look at the letter A, you have Acropolis, the Acropolis in Greece. You know the Acropolis, Acropole. In Spain, you have Alhambra, okay? And in Poland, Auschwitz. And I don't really see the end of it. Now, for the future of revisionism, I'm sorry, I think that we have to continue our academic work, our historical work, our scientific work. We have to be materialistic as much as possible. We have to try to find documents, to have them published. For instance, the Himmler's diary, if they are, as we think, in Israel. And the Mengele's papers. Four people on Earth know the content of the Mengele papers. And we know that Mengele said, all this is a pack of lies. This was Auschwitz. But it is not published. It's Eden. I would say that I am a bit all the same optimistic because I've noticed something which is quite new. I remember that years and years ago I received so many letters, phone calls and so on from people saying, now Mr. Faurisson, how could I answer this argument? Why could I, what could I say and so on? And now I noticed that many young people in this country and elsewhere are quite able to discuss the matter by themselves. They do not really need our help. And now, to be practical, I am waiting, as everyone, the opening of the Holocaust Memorial Museum in, I think, April 1993. I think that I'll come to the United States especially to visit it, if it's possible. Mark Weber told you that in 1982 we played a trick to a very big exhibition in France, in Paris, Place du Trocadéro. They did something enormous, fantastic, with electronics and so on. I went to this place with Pierre Guillaume. I noticed some little things, but I was very discreet in my corner, taking little notes. And we made a paper, 2 pages, not more than 2 pages. And we came back like visitors, and we put, I think, something like 3 or 4 of those papers. Not much money. We killed this exhibition with this. I can tell you, because This exhibition was supposed to go everywhere in France, and they stopped it. I phoned to the minister in charge of this, Ministère des Anciens Combattants, Veterans, and Victims of War, and on the phone I had a Mrs. Jacobs. And I said, what about this exhibition? Where is it? And she said, we are revising it. Oh, revising. It's somewhere, in some place. I said, yes, but when do you think we'll have any chance to see it? I cannot tell you. Could you tell me when you will be able to tell me? And she said, no. And we never saw it anymore. I think, and this is the air of it, I think that very hard times are coming. And I've met many Americans, I love American people, and they are positive and so on. And some say that all what you are telling us is not possible in this country because of the First Amendment and so on. Now, please, remember that the country where judicial notice was taken of the fact that Jews were gassed in Auschwitz 1944 was United States of America. In California, a judge did this in 1980. Remember that myself, I can say that I don't like the word of persecuted, but it seems it's a kind of persecution. I can say that I still receive a salary, not my salary, but someone like Fred Luchter, an American, is out of business. And be careful, Zündel has no right to get into your country. Now, this is a beginning. You have to be careful. But things might change for reasons totally independent of our researches. We don't know what is going to happen in Germany, for example. It could happen something in Germany. But more than ever, we need a kind of motto, and it's my motto. One day, as I told you, I think once, a defense lawyer came to me and said, Mr. Forrestal, I want to help you. And I said, who are you? What do you mean? And why? Why do you want to help me? And he said, because I consider that revisionism is the big intellectual adventure of the end of this century. And as usual, I would say, as for myself, I do not know any other intellectual adventure. It's my adventure, and it is yours.